Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. First Nations met with Prince Charles, and one chief says the meeting reaffirmed the relationship with the Crown. A United Nations committee is questioning why Canada hasn't done more to implement recommendations from the Iberwash Inquiry, and school's a challenge for anyone. However, the challenges are far greater for Aboriginal students, and a university professor discusses the statistics as well as how the gap can begin to close. Inuit youth are keeping their eyes on candidates running for president of Iñupitapirikami, and family, community and school support were key in an Aboriginal graduate's success in obtaining his medical degree. Ryan Life is one of University of British Columbia's largest class of Aboriginal graduates of its MD program. All of these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. First Nation leaders met the Prince of Wales earlier this week. Leaders discussed the relationship between the First Nations and the British Crown, which has been based on treaties. Dean Sayers, chief of Batchewana Bay First Nation in Ontario, was one of those leaders who attended the meeting. Sayers says the Prince listened to the chiefs and seemed to understand their issues, and he says Canada needs to change its attitude.
I don't see the proper reflection of the dialogue that we have with the Crown and the relationship we have with the Crown. So I think Canada needs to stand up and listen to what we're going to be saying in the next little while. I know our people and our leaders, in particular the Robinson Huron Treaty area, are getting really fed up. We're losing our patience with the continued theft of our resources, continued ill interpretation of our relationship. And I know that our people won't stand for it much longer. And it's unfortunate that it may end up going to possibly confrontation in the future, which is something that we don't encourage. But, you know, it's really hard to hold it back. It seems as though Canada doesn't want to properly deal with the issues they've inherited.
Sayers says the meeting between First Nations and Prince William was very significant. He adds there was more opportunity to discuss issues with Prince than there was when the Prime Minister held a meeting with First Nation leaders in January. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo says the meeting reaffirmed the Crown First Nation relationship. First Nation leaders would like to meet with the Queen next year for the 150th anniversary of the Royal Proclamation. A fire in a sweat lodge at a young offenders facility just outside Saskatoon is being investigated. CBC reports no one was seriously injured in the fire, which happened for a week ago. The outer layer of the sweat lodge came into contact with hot embers, and that started the fire. Three boys and four adults were able to get out. Officials with the Ministry of Social Services told CBC it will follow up to determine why there wasn't someone watching the door, a requirement when sweat lodge ceremonies are practiced. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has some tough questions for Canada. The independent body oversees the International Human Rights Treaty for the Prevention of Torture and Ill Treatment has asked Canada why it hasn't moved on recommendations from the Iberwash report. Craig Benjamin with Amnesty International in Canada says it's timely the committee will be inquiring about the report because it's been nearly 5 years since the Iberwash recommendations came out. Benjamin says there's been some movement, but not much implementation.
Well, there certainly has been steps on many of them. We're aware that the province has been working with the Aboriginal leadership in Ontario on a range of issues and concerns. And, you know, to the province's credit, immediately after the release of the inquiry report, the provincial government gave its commitment toward the full implementation of the report. However, critically, 5 years later, and 5 years is a long time, we see significant gaps in the implementation of the Iberwash Inquiry recommendations.
The Iberwash recommendations came after an inquiry was held into the OPP shooting death of Dudley George during a land occupation of Iberwash Provincial Park in 1994. There were 100 recommendations in that report. Ottawa is appealing the federal court ruling on First Nations child welfare. The Canadian Press reports the Justice Department filed notice May 18th that it intends to challenge the ruling. The federal court ruling confirmed that the Government of Canada could be held accountable under the Canadian Human Rights Act for ensuring that First Nations people on reserve have fair and equitable access to government services. In a media release, Cindy Blackstock, Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, said it's so disappointing to see the federal government put its interests ahead of the interests of children by again pursuing these legal technicalities and trying to avoid a full hearing on the discrimination matter. Meanwhile, government representatives told the Canadian Press that trying to compare federal funding to provincial funding is unfair. Inuit youth are keeping their eye on the presidential race for a leader of the organization Inuit Tapere Kanatami. Jennifer Watkins is the president of the National Inuit Youth Council, and she says they have posed questions to both candidates, Terry Odlaw and Robert Watt. Watson hopes the new president will work with youth.
Social problems revolve around young people, so hopefully one of the two candidates will keep that in mind and try to find out ways in the finding solutions together for our young people across northern Canada.
Outgoing President Mary Simon is not running for re-election. While in office, Simon's top priorities had been education and health. A man who has been convicted of theft charges has been re-elected as chief of his community. CBC reports Duane Antoine recently pleaded guilty to theft charges relating to Poundmaker Cree First Nation band money. Elections were held May 18th, and with three candidates running for chief, Antoine outpolled the nearest candidate by 74 votes. A community resident has told CBC that some people are calling for Chief Antoine's resignation. The band member also said under band custom, people convicted of theft or fraud from the First Nation are banned from council. Antoine was among other former and current band council members who faced charges stemming from allegations relating to treaty land entitlement money. He's to be sentenced in September. A Lakehead University professor says the education system in Ontario needs an overhaul to meet the needs of Aboriginal students. John Hudson says there's been some work done to meet the needs of the students. For instance, 5 years ago, the province released an Ontario Aboriginal Education Policy Framework, and since then, schools have begun to include more language programs and introduced a self-identification policy plus culturally appropriate signs and art. But that's not enough. Hudson says working teachers need more cultural awareness.
Now, there are some faculties in bed that have taken up mandatory courses in Aboriginal education so that every teacher candidate that comes through the walls of the Faculty of Education here, for instance, has to do a course, a mandatory course in Aboriginal education. And that's an important inclusion and important to the development of new teachers coming into the field. But you know what? There's nothing like that that's going on for teachers that are already in service. So what needs to happen?
Hudson says they're creating a program in Thunder Bay based on Maori programs that have significantly increased the Maori graduation rate in New Zealand. Ralph Life is a new doctor. He just graduated med school at the University of British Columbia. And the reason that's making news is because he was one of the largest classes of Aboriginal students to graduate medical school this year. There were 12 students accepting their medical degrees this week, and Life was lucky to have a lot of support that contributed to his success.
Hard actually applying and getting in and getting through the program. Family support, good mentors, the right environment, I guess, to feel confident enough to pursue our goals.
Life adds he also spent summers with an elder in his community in his younger years, and the hardest part of his educational career was getting through high school. And his advice for other students? Keep at it. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Smile, she said last night, could never forget. mountain out of my bed.
Stonefish with Pounding on My Soul. First Nation leaders met with the Prince of Wales earlier this week. Leaders discussed the relationship between the First Nations and the British Crown, which has been based on treaties. Dean Sayers, chief of Batchewana Bay First Nation in Ontario, was one of those leaders who attended the meeting. Sayers says the Prince listened to the chiefs and he seemed to understand their issues and was empathetic with them. But, Sayers says, Canada should start respecting the treaties and the First Nation relationship with the Crown. And here's part of our conversation.
I don't see the proper reflection of the dialogue that we have with the Crown and the relationship we have with the Crown. So I think Canada needs to stand up and listen to what we're going to be saying in the next little while. I know our people and our leaders, in particular Robinson Huron Treaty area, are getting really fed up. We're losing our patience with the continued theft of our resources, continued ill interpretation of our relationship. And I know that people won't stand for it much longer. And it's unfortunate that it may end up going to possibly confrontation in the future, which is something that we don't encourage. But you know, it's really hard to hold it back. It seems as though Canada doesn't want to properly deal with the issues that they've inherited by way of the repatriation of Canada's constitution in 1982. So that's basically a summary of what happened yesterday.
So how significant do you think the meeting actually was?
It was fairly significant, at least for me. I have another chance to meet with the representatives of the Crown, and I believe that involvement. I maximized my exposure and my few minutes to speak with him. I maximized explanations of the expected outcomes that I wanted to see on behalf of our people. And I think there was a lot more that was happening, because the other thing that happened, whether people realize it or not, there was a huge and extensive amount of ceremony that was taking place at the same time, making sure that the wishes and expectations of our ancestors were incorporated into the words that we shared. So it was more than what was meeting the eye that was taking place yesterday. There was a lot of spirit, there was a lot of ceremony that was incorporated to maximize the outcomes so that we as Anishinaabe can move forward and really realize expectations that were foretold to us in our prophecies and how we would move forward together with these people that were coming here.
And so what do you think the Prince can do as far as the concerns that you brought to him, as well as addressing the treaties and the Royal Proclamation?
Well, I believe that the Prince has the eye of the Commonwealth, the ear of the Commonwealth, and I believe that he has those mechanisms that he can share the perspective, the plight of First Nations people. We're asking him to share the message not only at the Commonwealth, but as well right here with the Canadian government. And that they are really compromising the honor of the Crown, the Canadian government I'm referring to, by way of their dealings with First Nations people. And I believe that there is a lot of power still reserved for the Crown in these lands. And last night was a good example of it when they sang God Save the Queen, you know, and all these other paternalistic, looking at the Queen as still being the leader, the head, the figurehead of Canada. And they, all the government people all swear allegiance to the Queen. Yet. So there's a tremendous amount of power that still lies with the Crown. And we're asking the Crown to exercise that power to some extent.
And so how do you feel about this meeting as opposed to the Crown First Nations gathering that happened last January?
I think we have a lot more control over the agenda here. We have a lot more control over the outcomes. And we've had an opportunity to actually befriend and sit with and confer with this particular leader. Whereas at the gathering on January 24th, we were kind of really distanced, and there was no opportunity to interact and share the expectation we have with the Prime Minister. There was a little more opportunity with the Cabinet, but as you see, the outcomes from that were, in my mind at least, were pretty well preset by the Prime Minister, in that what he really was, I guess, applauding himself for was all the legislation that was in the works and was going to be introduced was the best thing for the Indians, without any consultation, very paternalistic, and that was so wrong. So the expected outcomes, I think, in this particular instance, we have an opportunity to steer and guide based on our reality and our needs, which wasn't the same with the Crown First Nations gathering in Ottawa on January 24th.
You feel like the relationship between the British Crown has been reaffirmed with First Nations. And so why is that relationship important?
People have to recognize and understand that our treaty relationship is with the Crown. And Canada is not a treaty partner. Canada is the administrator. They have inherited the obligations of the Crown as set out in our treaty relationship. We have obligations as First Nations people. The Crown has obligations as Crown representatives, and Canada administers the Crown's obligations. Canada is not a treaty partner. They administer for us. We see the part of Canada as being administrators of the expectations of the Crown and the First Nations. We are encouraging the Crown to give further instruction to Canada on how they expect to see the relationship administered. As far as I'm concerned, the Prime Minister of Canada is our administrator. He works for First Nations and he works for the Crown. More particular, though, he represents the Crown in their obligations as set out in a treaty relationship.
That was Dean Sayers, Chief of Batchewana Bay First Nation. First Nation leaders in the country are requesting a meeting with the Queen next year, and that's to mark the 150th anniversary of the Royal Proclamation. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has some tough questions for Canada. The independent body oversees the International Human Rights Treaty for the Prevention of Torture and Ill Treatment and has asked Canada why it hasn't moved on recommendations from the IPRWASH report. Canada made its presentation to the committee May 23rd in Geneva. Since it's been nearly 5 years since the IPRWASH inquiry recommendation came out, Craig Benjamin with Amnesty International in Canada says it's timely that the committee is asking why the recommendations haven't been implemented.
Well, the United Nations, the various bodies that oversee human rights records of countries around the world, these bodies have long had an interest in the events at IPRWASH. United Nations human rights bodies had called for the inquiry and have called for implementation of the inquiry recommendations. But it's especially timely that this month, just on the eve of the fifth anniversary of the IPRWASH inquiry report, the United Nations Committee Against Torture, which is a preeminent human rights body, it's an expert body, independent body that oversees how states live up to their obligations, not only to prevent torture and ill treatment, but also to ensure accountability and justice for people who are the victims of ill treatment at the hands of police. And so it's really timely that this body happens to be meeting just before this anniversary. And the UN Committee Against Torture specifically asked Canada to report on the progress toward implementation of the IPRWASH inquiry recommendations.
So in the 5 years since the report, what has been done as far as recommendations go?
Well, there has been steps on many of them. We're aware that the province has been working with Aboriginal leadership in Ontario on a range of issues and concerns. And, you know, to the province's credit, immediately after the release of the inquiry report, the provincial government gave its commitment toward the full implementation of the report. However, critically, 5 years later, and 5 years is a long time, we see significant gaps in the implementation of the Upper Washington Inquiry recommendations. There's a couple that we've highlighted because we think that they are both important in their own right, but also that the failure to implement these recommendations undermines the whole implementation process. One of these is that the inquiry called for an independent evaluation of the Ontario Provincial Police framework for responding to Aboriginal protests. During the inquiry, the provincial police made quite a big deal of these new policies put in place after the tragic shooting of Doug George at Ipperwash Park. And the framework that the OPP had put forward is one which is consistent with international human rights standards. It essentially says that, recognizes that people do have the right to protest and that Aboriginal land protests involve a right protected in the Canadian Constitution. And therefore requires a complex, a nuanced, a careful police response based on the fundamental principle that police use of force should be kept to a minimum, as be proportionate to any threat to public safety, and really is there as a last resort. And the first choice, the first resort has to be one of negotiation. It's a really important framework. However, it's never been evaluated. So there's been no independent assessment of whether or not this policy that the OPP assured us, assured the public, assured the inquiry, was the appropriate and best response to making sure that there wasn't a repetition of what had happened at Ipperwash Park. There's been no independent evaluation to make sure that, in fact, they really have implemented this and that the frontline officers who are going to be involved in policing protests really understand the framework and know how to apply it, or that their superiors understand and apply the framework when they're making crucial decisions about how to deploy forces in advance of a protest. So that hasn't happened. And the other piece, and which is equally significant, is that the inquiry said that recognizing the public and political climate in which decisions get made, said that this framework, this approach of ensuring that the response of least use of force, minimum appropriate force, should not just be a policy only of the police, but needed to be a province-wide policy so that there would be political support for the decision to negotiate rather than remove protesters by force. And the province has failed to adopt that province-wide policy, leaving essentially many of the same concerns that came into play at Ipperwash, the possibility of political influence on police, the possibility that public misunderstanding or public lack of appreciation of the complexity of the situation could create pressure on police forces, leaving all these same problems potentially in place.
That was Craig Benjamin with Amnesty International. Now here's Missy Knott with Happy in the Sun. Took in your lesson.
happy in the sun.
A Lakehead University professor says the education system in Ontario needs an overhaul to meet the needs of Aboriginal students. John Hodson says there's a lot of cracks in the system where students will slip through, and he's been working to create a program for teachers to work culturally appropriately with students so the number of Aboriginal students graduating high school will increase. And where he got his ideas was New Zealand. He starts out with a provincial policy framework, and then he goes into statistics of Aboriginal graduation and retention.
Ontario released in 2007 what's known as the Ontario First Nation, Métis, and Inuit Education Policy Framework that has been developed to address some of the realities of Aboriginal kids in provincially funded schools. Probably at this point, there's about 100,000 of our kids in schools, elementary and secondary. About only 45% of our people between 15 and 24 have a high school diploma. Most of our kids go to provincial schools, and somewhere between 60 to 80% of our children drop out before grade 12. So what it leaves is a void in our communities in terms of expertise, in terms of earning power, in terms of economics, in terms of skills, like, you know, whether they're blue-collar skills or professional skills. We just don't have the kinds of expertise coming back into our communities because they're not graduating out of grade 12, and for the most part, because they don't graduate out of grade 12, we don't see them in higher education, whether it's colleges or universities. And there's this big population bubble that we're only starting to see the beginning of. One in five kids in this country are Aboriginal. And if you look at the statistics, what you see is that we're just at the beginning of this bubble. So if you go down to go to any elementary school in urban, in this territory, in an urban center, and what you'll see are some schools that have 28, 30, 40% Aboriginal kids in the elementary grades. And those kids will move on from, you know, elementary into secondary, and statistically will drop out before grade 12, the vast majority of them. In the Northwest, there are some boards of education that are really close, and I'm talking entire boards that are really close to 50-50 Aboriginal. And they'll move from 50-50 to 60-40 to 70-30. And we talk about, you talk about the resource development, for instance, just the resource development in First Nations communities and territories. What you won't see is the kinds of hiring and benefits from employment, because, frankly, we just don't have the folks coming out of the, you know, the higher education to work in those fields. So we'll be, as usual, in a back seat of the development that's going to be happening in the Northwest, resource development. Mm. And we won't see the benefits coming in our communities in multiple levels. Mm. So there's an economic argument, certainly for First Nation communities. There's also an economic argument for boards of education that are soon going to be at the 50-50 rate, where they're gathering considerable tuition revenue from First Nations communities. Their kids are going to those schools. And more, I hear anecdotal reports of, you know, band councils and tribal councils starting to look very carefully at the investments they're making in their kids and starting to talk on, you know, to boards of education about the return on their investment. And when you, in Ontario, especially in the Northwest, again, when you see a diminishing non-native population and an increasing, you know, Aboriginal population in schools, you really start getting a sense of the economic argument from boards of education's perspectives. If it wasn't for those tuition agreements, where tuition funds are being shuffled off from First Nations communities into boards of education, you would see a lot more closing of schools and laying off of teachers and cutbacks in the education sector altogether. So there's that argument. But the one that's most profound for me, the one that's most important, is the spiritual damage, the wounding that it does to our kids who drop out of school and really don't start making the connection to, you know, it's school that's failed them, not them that's failed schools. All kids want to learn, you know. You know, all kids are sponges. That's what they're about. They're all about soaking up as much as they can. And that's the message that, that, you know, that surrounds them. School is good. School is important. for your future, for your community's future. And when they can't measure up, you know, when they see their cousins and their aunties and their uncles and they're not measuring up, you know, the younger brothers and the younger sisters not measuring up, what message do they receive? You know, it's not an intellectual message that talks about the evidence and the research, et cetera, et cetera. What they say is, I didn't measure up. It's me. I'm the problem. So our kids walk away from school wounded in their spirits, and they carry that, many of them carry that for the rest of their lives. And that's the thing that really, it's the argument that really bothers me, that really is profoundly sad for me.
And so what kind of changes do you think can be made to the provincial education system to meet the needs of First Nations students?
Well, the policy framework has opened the door. You know, in the last 5 years, 4 years of activity in boards of education across the province, there has been activity, and some of it's been really positive activity. But for the most part, that activity has been about bringing more cultural identity into the schools. So if you walk into a school, you'll see more Aboriginal iconography on the walls. You might see language programming. You might see powwows in elementary schools. You might see elders being more involved in the education of the kids in those schools. And those are all important elements, don't get me wrong. All important elements. Kids need to see positive contemporary representation of who they are in their classrooms and in their school experience. But what we haven't seen yet is a province-wide shift in teacher practice on behalf of our kids. And that hasn't occurred yet. And the reason it hasn't occurred, I think, is that we've made an assumption about what teacher education is about in this province, and we just keep doing it. And I work in a faculty of education. I've worked in two, in fact, in my career to this point. And there is an assumption about what teacher education is about that has significantly left our kids behind. Now, there are some faculties vet that have taken up mandatory courses in Aboriginal education so that every teacher candidate that comes through the walls of the Faculty of Education here, for instance, has to do a course, mandatory course in Aboriginal education. And that's an important inclusion. And important to the development of new teachers coming into the field. But you know what? There's nothing like that that's going on for teachers that are already in service. So what needs to happen? I think it's the same as through an international indigenous research agreement is what we call Mama Westland, which is helping teachers work with our kids, helping build a cadre of educators that can work with our kids, and tracking the success of that. And our hope is that it'll go on to inform the balance of the province and provide a vision for this province and what needs to be done for the Ministry of Education to, you know, literally fix the problem.
That was John Hodson, the chair of the Department of Aboriginal Education at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay. Inuit youth are keeping a close watch on candidates in the race for leader of the organization Inuit Tapiri Kanatami. Jennifer Watkins is the president of the National Inuit Youth Council and says they want to know the candidates and know why they're running for leader.
Well, we've decided on our last conference call that we would ask the two candidates some questions in general to know about why they wanted to become the next leader for the National Inuit Body. And we felt that these questions were important because we wanted people to know in general, to know about who might be leading Inuit on the national level. Although the voting is done between regional land claim organizations and two delegates, but NIYC felt that the public should be talking about it and know about the election, that we challenge the candidates to tell us why they would be the right person to sit as president of ITK.
All right, and so why don't you tell us what some of those questions are?
One of the questions was, what fired you up enough to make you run for the presidency of ITK? Was there a defining moment? And please be specific. We wanted to know from the candidates what motivated them to run for ITK presidency, whether it was something they've considered before or if something happened recently that they felt so passionately about to lead this national organization.
All right. And so what does the Youth Council think of the two candidates so far?
All of us the National Inuit Youth Council. It's up to the leaders, up to the voters, but we're quite interested and we want the best for our people and the best for young people, because Mary Simon, the current president, had talked about how important the youth are, and hopefully the next new president will remain the same, and having the youth very important in our future, because we are more than 50% of the population and we have a young population in northern Canada. So hopefully the new president will keep the young people one of its top priorities.
The other thing is, what are your thoughts on outgoing President Mary Simon, and what kind of precedents has she set in the Youth Council's eyes?
Well, Mary, I've known Mary almost since I was a little girl. I think she's a lot of people's role model, and she was always my role model. And she's taught us a lot through NIYC. She came and sat and spoke to us a few times at the council and gave us her support and made sure the staff of ITK supported the National Inuit Youth Council. And we were sad to hear that she ain't running again. And she's taught us a lot, and as Inuit in general, a lot of topics such as education, mental health, was a big priority for Mary. And it brought us, it opened our eyes and point of view. So sad, but Mary will always be around.
Well, certainly big shoes to fill. And so how important do you think it is that a new president support the youth?
Hopefully the new president is very open to us, to the young people, to the young people we serve at the National Inuit Youth Council. Like I said, our population is quite young in the north, all over northern Canada, and a lot of our social problems revolve around young people. So hopefully one of the two candidates will keep that in mind and try to find out ways in finding solutions together for our young people across northern Canada.
That was Jennifer Watkins, president of the National Inuit Youth Council. Now here's Inuit artist Tanya Tagak with Ancestors. Yeah. Is not easy for anyone. And earlier in the program, you heard about the extra hurdles that Aboriginal students face in mainstream educational institutes. But hard work and family support paid off big time for 31-year-old Ryan Life. The brand new proud doctor is from Suki Nation in BC, and I spoke to him on the day he graduated medical school on May 23rd from the University of British Columbia. The graduation made headlines because he was one of 12 Aboriginal graduates that completed medical degrees, and that's the largest pool of Aboriginal MD grads the school has seen to date.
A lot of people put in a lot of hard work to recruit us and familiarize us with the program. And so James Andrew in particular, he's the face and the legs and probably the brains of the program too. You know, the road to medical school starts before admission. So prior to actually applying and getting in and getting through the program, family support, good mentors, the right environment, I guess, to feel confident enough to pursue our goals. Because a lot of help is basically what it takes to succeed.
Okay, and so we know that there's an incredibly high dropout rate for Aboriginal students in high school and not a whole lot graduating from post-secondary school, college, or university. And so what has been the really big difference for you?
I don't know. I guess it's a number of things. I mean, I was growing up, my family was very, very poor. I remember watching American TV shows where paying for college was always a big issue on sitcoms like Family Ties and whatnot. And my parents always said, oh, you don't have to worry about that because the band will pay for your tuition when you go to college. And that kind of put the idea in my head that, one, college was an option, and two, it would be paid for, so I didn't have to worry. But this is when I'm, under 10 years old. And so, I don't know, I had a pretty typical course through college. 75% of us do drop out. I remember I was almost expelled in grade 7 for skipping school so much that I had friends in high school, and I spent a lot of time fostering at my uncle's house, at a friend's house, and at a friend's parents' house. I did most of high school living there. So they just provided a nice environment for me to do my thing, and really great teachers. In addition to that, I had support when I was younger from an elder who lived on my reserve, Uncle Jim, that's what I call him. I don't know how we were related, really, but after I turned 8 and 9, I spent summers there. So I had a bunch of help from people being patient and generous with me.
And so as an Aboriginal student and dogging it through medical school, was there anything that you utilized as an Aboriginal student, like Aboriginal Student Services or anything else there that was assistance to your success?
Well, James Andrew, he recruits us, interviews us with a panel of other people to see if we're right for the program. And then he comes to visit us regularly to talk, so he plays a lot of roles. Wears a lot of hats for us. So if we have problems, we're free to call him whenever he can advocate for us. Other than that, I don't think I accessed any kind of emotional support that was specific for Aboriginal students. The UBC School of Medicine has an Office of Student Affairs, which has quite a bit of power, and there's deans, and they have a lot of resources, and it's just for helping students out, so anyone can go there, Aboriginal, not Aboriginal. In addition, we have Jane.
What kind of advice would you have for other students out there?
Keep at it if you're interested. Pursue your interest. It's hard to believe that you can do something if your parents haven't done it. I think, you know, jobs tend to run in families. I'm the first person in my family to finish a bachelor's degree, let alone a doctor of medicine degree. And it gets easier, I find. And people like to say, you can be anything you want to be, which sounds nice when you're really abstracted from a process. But there's we learned this in medical school, there's a very big difference between theoretically being able to do something and then actually being familiar enough with the process that you initiate it yourself. I don't know if that makes sense. But if you're interested in something, just poke around online or start asking counselors. And there's a lot of help out there. You know, the toughest part for me was getting through high school. And after that, you know, there just seems to be more and more help available as I've come through my education.
That was Dr. Ryan Life on his graduation day. And I think he already sounds like a doctor. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts, and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.